Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families for more than 100 years. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
From Idaho Falls, Idaho, this is the closing market report for the 13th day of July, 2018. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason at Anheuser-Busch's Grower Days here in the great state of Idaho. Coming up in this half hour, we'll of course talk with the folks from Anheuser-Busch about barley and its purpose in beer and how their plant here, the malting plant, works with local farmers and what that means for St. Louis and other breweries across the United States. We'll also take a look at, of course, what happened in Chicago at the CME Group. Mike Zuzulo will be here from Atchison, Kansas, and Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. He'll also take up with us yesterday's World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates report. And as we wrap up our time together, we'll discuss the weather forecast. Eric Snodgrass will be here from Agrible, right here on Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Just a couple of quick notes about my travels westward from Illinois to Idaho. I'm looking at the corn crop. I made a beeline straight west from Champaign, meaning through Jacksonville, and then on to Missouri and across the top of that state on 36. And while there isn't a whole lot of corn there that is enough to make a difference in the total size of the U.S. crop, as reported by WASD yesterday, they have had a very tough time in the north central part of Missouri and the south central part of Iowa as it relates to corn production. If you watch the drought monitors, you've seen that they've been dry all year long, and that crop is seriously damaged. Past pollination at this point, and they will have a tough year in front of them. Once I came through the end of Missouri and then turned northward into Nebraska and hit Interstate 80 and made my way across that state, a couple of things struck me. Most of that state's corn crop is behind ours by probably, at least a month, so they won't go into pollination for a while at this time. And then the other item there is that it actually looks really, really good. And of course, that crop stretches much farther west than I suspected, maybe about 80% way across the state of Nebraska. So those are just a couple quick items as I made my way here to Idaho Falls. We'll talk about that more later. Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklovic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzulum. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, dedicated to helping farm families succeed by offering financial products and services geared specifically to agriculture and rural communities, and developing partnership-based relationships with its member owners.
This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason, coming to you today from the Anheuser-Busch Grower Day in Idaho Falls. We're going to talk to the brewmaster in just a few minutes here, but right now we're joined by Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Hope your days is beautiful there as it is here in Idaho Falls, Mike.
It's another nice 100-degree day, and we watch the crops continue to suffer, Todd, as the markets continue to go lower. So it's been a wonderful day and a wonderful week overall, and we're just blessed that we didn't have a negative report reaction from a USDA report completely.
Well, yeah, that's a tough day. It is a gorgeous day here, so we're probably in the upper 70s at the moment, though we're going to get into the heat by about 3:30 this afternoon, and it'll drop back down fairly quickly, but we're in a high desert here. I think that's fairly normal for what they suffer through sometimes in this part of the year. Very hot where you are. The market had what kind of day today? Let's go through some of the numbers first from the corn.
Yeah, we had the July futures going off the board at noon Central Time, so the market was very volatile right around noon and then closed or settled down very, very much in between then and the close, and then got volatile again. A relatively light volume day. July corn closed down 6.25 at 3:30 1/4. December corn down 5.5 at 3:53 3/4. Corn was the one that probably was most disappointing, if you ask me, Todd, given the report and given the fact that the wheat was able to have another double-digit gain today, led by the European market.
Yeah, go ahead and give me the wheat numbers, please.
July wheat expired, very thin trade, down 1 cent at 481.5. In fact, the volume was 8 contracts. The next closest contract, which is now lead month, is going to be September, and the soft red up 12.5. at 497. Meanwhile, hard red in September up 10.25 at 491.5. Spring wheat in September down 0.5 at 530.
As you mentioned, yesterday's world agricultural supply and demand estimates, fairly friendly, actually I would think really friendly for the corn market. What'd you think of those numbers?
I thought they were too, and I think especially when you look at the total grain number as a whole, Todd, you saw a number that between July and June's total grain ending stocks, excluding the oil seeds, down over 1% or about 8 million tons on a drop in production. And so that was mainly wheat and corn. And I think this is where we are starting to see more and more likelihood of the U.S. gaining more and more market share in the export market. In fact, the world wheat stocks to use number now is, in terms of major exporters that compete with us, at a record low of 13%. You couple that with the corn increase in demand of 125 million bushels in the exports, and you have a really good reason, and it made logical sense why the trade decided to come back in and buy corn and sell beans on Thursday and keep the wheat very well underpinned as the European drought continues to get worse and worse. Unlike us here in the United States, their corn and wheat crops look like they're going to suffer a whole nother week of problems and hot, dry weather.
On that note, what did the soybean numbers finish up like on this Friday afternoon?
July beans down 16 at 8:14. Here again, very thin trade, only about 99 contracts traded there. November beans down 14.75 at 8:34.5. The meal market, the one that you and I talked a lot about last week at this time, did settle and stay above in the July contract, above its 200-week moving average, down 4.60 at 3:28.80. The now new lead month August contract is $3.10 cheaper than that. So coming back Monday, I'd want to see that August meal really jump and find some support on what would be looking like a gap that's left over from today's price action and July expiration.
Do you think that can happen?
I do. I mean, the crush margins are at $2.20. They're at the best price since 2014, 2015, when we were trading 10 to 11.50 beans. So the money is there to crush more. And, you know, Todd, we're at a point now where we factored in about 20 to 21% of the 25% tariff at this stage. If we come back with a little bit of missed rains, which the European model is starting to give us a little bit drier bias and a little bit more patchy rainfall, you see that, and then you see the crop conditions, I think maybe we could see the meal find a reason to bottom. But after this report, I think it's pretty safe to say that the corn and the wheat are both kind of trapped until the soy meal and the beans make a low.
Yeah, so the report showed that USDA, figuring in the impact of the tariff, now says 580 million bushels will be left over from the crop that we harvest and the total production from this year by the time we get to next fall. That's a big increase over the previous report, I think somewhat, 250 million bushels, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, the Chinese consumption for soybeans went down almost 5 million tons, both in USDA figures yesterday and Chinese figures that were released a few hours earlier. So we are seeing that demand destruction occur as a result of this protectionism. That's what you don't want to see, either through substitution or through just outright finding better ways to make do with less. And obviously they did buy ahead in China because they do have a record soy meal stockpile over there right now on a national basis.
Let me come back to something I believe you told me, that you think the wheat and corn potential is capped by what's happening in the soybean market. Is this right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, especially with the NAFTA being an uncertainty. If we would get a NAFTA deal relatively soon, I think then the corn and the wheat maybe could go on their own and start to lead the beans up. But you've got to get some good trade news out of the government and out of the world news. And until you get that, then you're just waiting for the beans to find their low. And I think the first thing to bottom, because of the supply-demand fundamentals and the sheer crush margin profitability, is that meal contract.
So your expectation then is that we have more downside potential in the bean market.
Well, like we talked about, I think, last week, is if you don't hold that 200-week moving average, and yes, there is another wave down, and that's what I'm writing about in this week's newsletter, is that you essentially lost $85 between the May high and the June low in meal. If you take out this 200-week moving average and you throw out a 38% retracement of that $85 hit, then you're talking about going down to around $300 a ton. And there's a lot of support around there, but that's quite a bit of ways from where we're at right now at 326, 328.
Are you giving producers any new advice as related to either corn, soybeans, or wheat?
Yeah, in fact, I'm suggesting go ahead and get your feed needs locked in for corn. I'd booked some closer to $4 in December corn back in early December or early June before we had the big rains, the crop-saving rains. Now that we're 50 cents lower, I'm going ahead from September all the way through the end of the calendar year at this price. I hate to say it, but I almost feel like this is a gift to the livestock producers as far as the corn prices in the cash market right now, because we are seeing the tightest ending stocks number since 2012. And even if we throw a U.S. national yield of 180 out there, that's about 12.5 million tons more than what USDA is suggesting. Between the EU, Mexico, and Ukraine, I think you could erode about 10 million tons of that 12.5. So I think maybe there's another 100 million bushels of carryover out there to be had on a global basis. So I think this is a good spot to get some of those needs locked in on the corn.
Now, speaking of the livestock, how did the hogs and the cattle settle for the day?
You know, the hogs really looked good up until the news flattening out on NAFTA. In fact, there was some news wire rumor mill talk that the NAFTA was not going to get addressed in the month of July, and I think that really deflated the market. Having said that, I'm still surprised that the August hogs are at $70, and the July hogs are still running around $80. They're not buying into the idea of much demand destruction in the meat sector, and that really kept them nice this week. We're still above 150 in feeder cattle.
All right, and the CME Group settlement prices were for those contracts?
Yeah, August fat cattle down 15 cents at 104.55, July hogs up 7 at 79.95, August feeder cattle down 25 at 150.77.
Thanks so much, Mike. Mike Suzalo, of course, is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Well, as you know, we're here today in Idaho Falls at Anheuser-Busch's, or AB InBev's, Grower Day at their malting plant. This plant is not all that old. The one in Moorhead is much, much older, but this plant built in the 1980s and in addition put on in the 2000s. It's a pretty good-sized plant. About half of all the malt that goes into the Budweiser products comes from this particular plant. So from Idaho Barley, we're now joined by Dave Taylor. He's a vice president of supply management and a brewmaster for Budweiser. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks, Todd. It's great to be here.
So last night at the media dinner, you were talking about the importance of the relationship that Budweiser has with its growers, but just the importance of barley growers to the whole product. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, our company was founded on a heritage of quality. And we reference back to our beginnings. There's some great quotes by Adolphus Busch where he says, "Nothing is too good for the Anheuser-Busch beer, and it takes great barley to brew great beer." So we anchor these principles in what we do today so we can guide our brewing initiatives, you know, for the next 100 years. And so the very first principle is we use the very best raw ingredients. And, of course, one of the key ingredients is great malted barley. So we have our barley research facility that works with our growers and develops new barley strains. We have growers that have been with us for 50 or 60 years. We have third and fourth generation growers. These partners are really essential to driving the quality of all of our products, especially Budweiser and Bud Light. So we taste our barleys every day. We get excellent barley from this region, and it's just a pleasure to be here today to say thank you to all of them.
Tell me about the farmers in this region and why you're located here. Because most of the time, if we think, and those of us in agriculture think about barley, and Idaho is the number one barley producing state in the nation. However, most of us will think about northern Minnesota, parts of the Dakotas is a place where barley is grown. And barley is a relatively young crop in Idaho.
Yeah, well, we use two types of barley mainly. We use a two-row barley, and the two-row barley grows very, very well in this region. It's a nice plump kernel. It's got a great sweet flavor. Whenever we try to develop any new barley variety, the first foremost objective is how good is the beer we brew with that malt. And so Idaho is an amazing region for the two-row, and when you go over into Minnesota and Fargo and in those areas, we see a little more six-row production there. So we've had a great history here since we opened the plant here in Idaho, and we get some great barley from this region.
Yeah, so the barley grown here is primarily two-row. It's sometimes about consistency, and it's also about efficiency. Is there a difference in the length of time, for instance, that it takes to put to malt barley that's two-row versus six-row?
Some malt houses have slightly different processes, so it's not grossly different. We see a little different flavor coming out of the two varieties. We get a little more sweetness. So it's really more about the flavor we can bring into the beer on two-row versus six-row. They behave a little bit differently. And when you look at the barley, especially the Budweiser, the Bud barley, we call it, that Bud malt spec, boy, the two-row barley here in the Idaho region is fantastic. And then likewise, when we go to six-row in the Minnesota area, we use that in other recipes. We do use that in Bud and Bud Light. And it comes in some other brands as well. So it takes about the same amount of effort, you know, to harvest and to malt those barleys, but they grow differently in the different regions, and we use them for different brands.
So you do some of the supply. Tell me about moving barley from one place to the other, because these plants, the one in Moorhead, the one here in Idaho Falls, are fairly good distances. I don't know what the closest brewery might be, and maybe Los Angeles to this particular plant, but there's a lot of logistics that take place. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of logistics to get barley malted and moved, and it moves in just regular grain hopper cars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so interesting. The 98% of all the beer we sell in the United States is brewed right here in the United States. And almost 99% of the malt we use for all that beer is grown right here in the United States, half that here in Idaho. So when you look at barley, we typically see our malt houses very close to our barley growers. That's why we bring a lot of our barley here out of Idaho, because once the barley is malted, it is considerably lighter. So it's actually, from a logistics standpoint, much better to ship the malt than it is to ship the barley, because you have considerably less moisture. It's not as heavy. So what we see is we'll be able to truck here into the malt plant right from the farmers. We'll be able to receive it. We'll be able to malt it. And then we typically use rail car to come out of our malt houses and do those longer distances, where we might be going from this plant to Jacksonville, Florida, for example, or Los Angeles, California. Our closest brewery to here is probably our Fort Collins brewery, but this plant actually supplies all of our U.S. brewery operations. Almost everyone in the United States uses two-row barley from Idaho.
What is the primary ingredient in beer?
Ooh, well, there are four primary ingredients in beer. Beer is actually a very simple product, a very wholesome product. Water, obviously pure high-quality water, is the first and largest ingredient in beer. Barley, malted barley, is very, very important. It brings the balance of beer. We call it the soul of beer. It brings sweetness. It brings a lot of that body you're used to having there in a beer. Then the balance of that maltiness is hops. So whether it's more hops or less hops, it's about the balance with the malt that really gives a beer its identity and its profile. We look at Budweiser and Bud Light, it's particularly about balance, about crisp, clean, refreshing. One of our big hop farms actually is also here in Idaho. So, you know, without barley, there's no malt. Without malt, there's no beer. So each one of the four core ingredients are just essential to beer. And then in the American lager style beer, that fourth ingredient, of course, is fresh rice, which we'll get out of Arkansas and Texas. And that's another source of making that beer crisp and clean. So, I mean, it's about the quality of that barley. That's where it starts.
It's a Budweiser. These products are truly American products.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. 18,000 employees here in the United States to grow the product, to malt the product, brew the product, distribute, sell, et cetera. And that's not counting our big distribution network, all of our distributor partners. So it is an American product brewed for Americans. And what separates it from other beers is truly the quality of the ingredients. Best ingredients, best people, best technology. And that's how I brew the best beers.
How often do you have to update the barley varieties to make them current and for yield to stay high enough that producers will continue to contract grow with Anheuser-Busch?
Well, it's a continuous process. We are actually crossing over 1,200 strains a year. It takes 7 to 10 years to develop a barley strain. Sometimes it can take me 2 years to evaluate the flavor of the malt we produce from a barley strain. And that's all about the partnership with our growers, creating a barley variety that's going to give good yield, that's going to have good agronomics in the field. But at the end of the day, it's about the quality of the beer we can produce with the malt. And so it's a long process, but it's helped us really make sure we have a good partnership and we can keep barley a competitive crop.
So you told me that it takes you sometimes 2 years to think about the flavor of the malt. So you're involved intimately in the process.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's lots of objectives when you develop a new barley strain, but yield and agronomics, it's about sustainability for the future. It doesn't matter if we can't brew a great beer from that product. So we'll come through and we'll start working on a barley strain, and we'll grow that barley, we'll malt that barley, we brew beer with that barley, and then we taste that beer multiple times, blind. We have to make absolutely sure that it's the finest quality beer being made by the highest quality ingredients. Then we look to what barley strains are going to perform the best, how do we adjust and let the growers work together to grow it the best way, malt it in the best way. So it's an ongoing process, but that's why you have 1,200 tries going on at any given time. And it's all natural barley crosses at our barley research facility in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Finally, last night at the media event, there was a specially brewed beer for that event. Can you tell me about it?
The guys on my team brewed that in the research pilot brewery there in St. Louis. We like to brew a special beer for an event, and we call this one a First Harvest Budweiser. So I don't remember the exact specifications, but the intention was we took some of the first harvest we were seeing from the crop year. We took that, we malted that quickly, and we came through and we tried to brew something that was a little sweeter, a little fuller, a little maltier to help us celebrate this event and come through with something that showed our appreciation to our barley growers.
Well, for me, the little sweeter, heavier flavor, the darker color was just magnificent. Thank you.
Yeah, it was a great beer. And if you haven't tried our Freedom Reserve, that's exactly the kind of things we're capable of. And Freedom Reserve is an amazing beer. And if you like that darker, maltier, fuller, little hint of molasses, give Freedom Reserve a try.
Thanks so much. Dave Taylor is a brewmaster and vice president of supply management at Anheuser-Busch AB InBev. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're here in Idaho Falls at the Budweiser malting plant.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
It's National Ice Cream Day. It's also National French Fries Day. As early as the 1680s, potatoes were fried in the Spanish Netherlands. French fry recipes began showing up in U.S. cookbooks as early as 1813, but date back in French cookbooks to at least 1755. On this day in agricultural history in 1568, the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral developed a method to bottle beer. In 1779, William Headley was born, an English coal mine official and inventor. He was probably the first to build a commercially viable steam engine dependent on friction between the wheels and rails, as opposed to a geared track. In 1794, James Lynn died. Lynn was a Scottish physician who recommended that fresh citrus fruit and lemon juice be implemented in the seamen's diet to eliminate scurvy. Sir Gilbert Blane made Lynn's suggestion a requirement, and scurvy was eradicated in the British Navy. By the way, the Dutch had been using citrus to combat scurvy since at least 1594, 2 centuries earlier. And in 1937, the first Krispy Kreme donut was sold in Salem, North Carolina. The first donuts went to grocery stores, but it was not long before people began stopping by Vernon Rudolph's donut operation and asking for hot donuts to go. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report, coming to you from the Anheuser-Busch Grower Days in Idaho Falls. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Eric Snodgrass is now here to take a look at the weather forecast. Eric, what can you tell me about the next few days?
Well, Todd, we're going to be in a bit of a roller coaster ride for the next few days, and this is what I'm talking about. There's a low pressure system that's kind of moving through parts of Canada right now, and it's draping a pretty large cold front to its south. And that cold front's stretching through parts of Wisconsin into Minnesota, into Iowa, parts of South Dakota, and Nebraska. So that is where right now the thunderstorm activity is concentrated. But because it's there, we're still to the south of it, which means we're getting some flow out of the Gulf of Mexico. Our dew point temperatures are high, and our temperatures are going to go right up into the lower 90s. In fact, we're going to see lower 90s today and tomorrow, and they've issued actually heat advisories and heat warnings just a little bit to our west. Now, that front is finally going to be moving over our part of the Corn Belt here in central Illinois by the time we get into Saturday and Saturday evening. So that's when I'm starting to see this risk for thunderstorms kind of increase, and I think we're going to have a risk of thunderstorms from multiple systems starting Saturday and carrying us all the way through Monday. Now, where the rain is currently falling in parts of Iowa and Minnesota, they are already at 200%+ of normal on precipitation. So I talked to some farmers there just the other day, and they don't want this. They don't want the rain. They want the cooler weather, but they do not want the rain. They're worried a little bit about the quality of that crop just sitting in so much standing water at this time of year. So again, that front moves through us, gives us our chance of precipitation, and this is where things get interesting. We're going to see for the first time probably in quite some time a pretty decent pattern flip. And what I mean by that is we've really favored, at least for the end of June and the beginning of July, an eastern Corn Belt ridge and an eastern United States ridge. And what we are finally seeing is stuff that we've been talking about now for at least a week, is that we're going to start to see that ridge finally retreat to the west. And as it retreats west, we're going to have, in general, an upper-level flow pattern that's above our heads here that's going to be from the northwest, putting us into a kind of a Great Lakes trough situation aloft. Now, what does that mean? We're still going to be seeing temperatures that are going to be in the 80s, but we're going to have our overnight lows finally coming down out of the 70s, getting back into the 60s more permanently. And as far out as we can go in the long-term forecasts from our long-range models, that takes us out about 2 weeks, we see this pattern staying established. So the west is going to be warming up. The ridge axis is going to be stretching right there along the middle part of the Rocky Mountains in the Intermountain West. So the ridge is pretty far to the west. We get northwest flow out of this. That's gives us a lot of what we call ridge riding thunderstorms. And it takes our temperatures out of those, out of that category where it could be, get kind of dangerous, and back down into more, well, I think what corn would love, temperatures in the mid 80s. We need to put this all in the context of our growing season. Remember, we're 300 to 380 growing degree day units ahead of average. So we were the fastest to silking since 2012. And in fact, if you look back to 1980, this was the fastest to still, second fastest to silking that we've had. So our big questions is, does this pattern last, through August. In other words, are we going to be able to keep that corn plant alive long? Are we going to be able to give us another long grain fill time period? My answer to you is the longer range forecast models have been so bad with picking up on precipitation patterns that I don't even trust the new ones that were just released just because of their past performance. So I think we're going to have to watch this weather 2 weeks at a time and just every day keep looking out 2 weeks to see how things evolve. And right now, that pattern suggests heat stays west, ridge riding thunderstorms come through, corn belt stays wet. So it's going to be another one of those years. I think we're having a hot and wet summer overall, and that's going to, I think, lead to another a decent year in terms of yields.
That's Eric Snodgrass from Agrible, joins us here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. From Idaho Falls, I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.